Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 1:37 p.m. on Tuesday, March 15th, 2016. Here we have present today Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, Representative Munoz, Representative Edgman, and I'm sure the others will be joining us shortly. On today's, before we start, remind everybody that cell phones and electronic devices are not allowed in the committee room. Before we start, I'd like to remind them of that. Anyway, next we have two bills today, House Bill 77, Disability ID License and Training Requirements, and HB 231, Extend the Board of Parole. I do not intend to move either of these bills today. First up, we will have House Bill 231, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Parole and providing for an effective date. This is sponsored by Representative Bob Lynn, and here to present HB 231 is Representative Bob Lynn and his staff, Esther Remilke. Please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation on HB 231.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Finance Committee. My name is Bob Lynn, representing District 26 in South Anchorage, and I have HB 231 this morning. One of your members asked me if this was a good bill, and I said, well, all my bills are good bills. So if you'd like me to make my comments now.
Go right ahead. Do you want to present the bill? Or?
Again, thank you very much. Again, HB 231 extends the termination date of the Board of Parole from this June 30th, 2016 until June 30th, 2022. That's a six-year extension of the Board. The Board of Parole provides a vital function in corrections and public safety. Last year, there was a legislative audit on the Parole Board, and that audit found some areas that needed improvement. Recommendations for improvement are in the sponsor statement. Basically, there was a need for improvement in the area of accuracy of parole files, notifications, proposed regulation changes, and the security of the corrections office information system. There are some folks here from the Department of Corrections or online, one or the other, who can provide more information on that if you so choose. I respectfully request, when you're ready, that you pass HB 231 out of committee. I also have my staffer, Nathan here, Esther Melke. There's a lifeline on this bill if you need any more information. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the five full-time employees, are those the same five people who serve on the board? Or is it five board members and then five employees?
There goes my lifeline right there.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson.
Place yourself on the record.
My name is Esther Milkey, staff to Representative Bob Lynn. In the audit, it says that I do believe the page... Page one, they have the list of all the members who are the on the board, and then the list of officers that are the positions that are filled with through the fiscal note.
Does that answer your question, Representative Wilson?
I don't see my page one. Is obviously not your page one.
It's page one of the audit. There's the... There's the table of contents, and then if you turn to eventually, it's under organization and function.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Okay, so if I understand it correctly, so these are the positions that are paid, and then there's an additional five that sit actually on the parole board.
Is that correct?
To the chair, I believe so, but I think we have somebody from the Division of Audit who can confirm that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to figure out who we're paying and who we're not.
Okay. Go ahead. Place yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, legislative auditor. Our agency did conduct a sunset audit of the board. And the audit doesn't discuss how many staff support the board has. We do explain how much their personal service budget covered. The board does get paid a daily fee, I believe, and a fee for reviewing the files. So they're like a part-time, no-benefit position, but they also have an executive director and staff.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, I thought this was like an easy question. I'm just trying to make sure. Okay, so on our fiscal note, it has full-time positions as five. And I read that the people on the board were part-time. I'm just trying to figure out whether or not these five people are different than the five people that are actually on the board.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, questions about the fiscal note could be addressed to the department for definitive answers, but the full-time positions would have to be staff positions because the board is part-time.
Okay, one other question.
Representative Wilson.
Okay, this is in the audit, so maybe we'll get the answer to the other one from whomever. So on page 16, and this is just clarification for me, so on Exhibit 4, and it talks about revoke and reparole, it appears that we're revoking and reparoling more people between 2011 and 14 than we did 2004 to 2007, which seems like a bad thing. Or am I reading those percentages as being we're doing less of that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the audit interprets it as a good thing in that in 2004 through 2007, the high rate of revoking and denying is reflective of a lack of programs out in the community. So they didn't have the programs that they have now available. So according to the department and to the board, more folks were, when they had parole violations, their parole was revoked and they were reinstitutionalized. What we found in 2011, 2014, that those rates of denying were less and they were more opportunity to get those folks into programs to help them be successful out in the community.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, so you're saying although it's still a high number percentage of revoking and reparoling, then we look at the next column, which says we're not letting them just sit in jail for the remainder of the time, that we're basically giving them a second or third chance, and that's what we see in the next column on that portion of it.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll ask whoever at the table can answer it easily. With the increased workload of the correction system, I just wonder if having five members of the Board of Parole is sufficient. Maybe I'll ask Ms. Curtis if your review indicated that there was an appropriate number of staff to the workload. Is five people enough to do the job required of the Parole Board?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, what our audit concluded was that the board was operating in a professional manner and an efficient manner. We were not told that they didn't have enough resources. What we found is that they were efficient in that they were not full-time. They were able to review their cases and process their cases within their available resources.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, I guess, for Chris. In the recommendation that you've made to extend for 6 years, can you tell me why 6 years was chosen as opposed to a shorter window so that some of these operational issues can be addressed?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. When we do an extension recommendation, a lot of things play into it. The four recommendations we have there are very administrative in nature and really collectively didn't impact a shorter recommendation. Those statutes provide for the maximum of 8 years, and there are costs that go into the audit process, so we do weigh those resources and how often we go back to review. The reason why we recommended 6 years was the significant changes going on in the correctional field, and that it would warrant legislative oversight sooner than 8 years. So we recommended 6 years. We also note that they are using a new risk assessment tool that began in 2014 to evaluate risk of offenders, and we thought it would be good to come back and look at that earlier than 8 years.
So through the chair.
Yeah, and we do have people from the parole board available for questions also, and even maybe some more help. Parole board and Department of Corrections are available, so we'll get back to them if you need to. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that's the reason why I asked why 6 years was an appropriate number. It seems extra lengthy, especially when they're using a new tool. And it was mentioned, just the first recommendation from LBNA was that improve procedures to ensure documentation. I'm a little bit worried because out of the 38 that you ended up auditing, out of the 321 total, there were seven errors. That's 18%. Seems like a pretty high number to me, and I'm not really sure why that is or what was found. But in doing the assessments, if the board doesn't have, it says, I guess, if the board doesn't have all required documentation for providing accurate information, it increases the risk of the board may reach misinformed decisions regarding the suitability of an offender for parole. I guess I'm concerned with that high number, and I'm wondering, we always get these sunsets before us, and we always say, geez, we need to change something. We need to bring up a following statute to address these, and it seems like we just let them go. We have a three-line bill, and then we just pass it on for another 6 years, and some of the problems are still there. So I'm wondering if you could address that first recommendation, which seems like a big one to me.
Absolutely. Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. The errors we found, recommendation one, we found errors with the risk assessment forms not being tabulated correctly, which is pretty significant. However, none of our errors impacted the risk category that they were in. So there was no actually impact to the errors. The other errors were documentation issues that we believe could be readily addressed by improved procedures. And so then we look to the department for corrective action. How willing are they to implement corrective action? Where are they at in that implementation? So the departments in the board's response are in the back. We felt changes are very simple. They're going to be very easy to implement and wouldn't warrant us coming back for that type of oversight and the cost of the audit any time earlier than 6 years.
Further questions from committee? Excellent. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably should have followed this up and perhaps Ms. Curtis again is the person to answer, but if the board can operate, first of all, you said that there's a full-time executive director and the other three filled positions are part-time. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe there is an executive director and several staff that work full-time for the executive director. I'm looking back to my staff, and here's nodding yes.
Okay. Well, the question through the chair, I guess the question I would ask is it necessary to have all those staffers who are in a budget-cutting mode and given the number of cases and the work they do, could they possibly get by with one fewer position?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, we didn't go in there with that type of focus. We didn't. What we looked at is their workload. They accomplish quite a large amount of work given their part-time status. Looking through their files, it is an extensive process to evaluate each offender. They also establish parole conditions for folks that are released on parole. They conduct hearings to evaluate parole violations. So there's quite a bit of work to do, and a lot of that involves a lot of paperwork. So I don't feel I have enough evidence or review to actually comment on whether positions could be cut. And that might be a question for the board to see how they're feeling about their resources.
Okay. Follow up again.
Representative Sadler.
And again, looking at the page one of the audit under organization functions, Exhibit 2 is a list of authorized positions and their status. Can you tell me which of the filled positions are part-time and which are full-time? This is on the bottom of page one of your audit.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, Exhibit 2 on page 1 of the audit would all be full-time positions.
These are all full-time? Four, five.
I believe so. I have no knowledge that any of these are part-time. But that, again, could be addressed to the department. I think they would know that.
Unless Representative Lynn or Ms. Mielke can answer the question, I'll defer until get the board up there.
No, you're ready.
To the chair, Representative Sadler, I believe Jeff Edwards is online. He should be able to answer that.
All right, further questions Representative Munoz.
Thank you. On page 16, Chris, could you explain the terminology in this graph, revoke and reparole, revoke and deny, reprimand and warn?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, revoke and reparole, I'm just going back to my own knowledge on working at corrections audits in the past. Parole violation occurs. The offender is brought before the board for consideration of that violation. Their parole conditions could be amended at that point. They could be directed into additional programs. They could have additional restrictions put on them. But ultimately, they are re-paroled back into the community. Revoke and deny would be the same situation, except that the violations and the nature of the case, so to speak, would justify that they be reinstitutionalized.
And
follow up, Representative Munoz.
Mr. Chairman, reprimand and warn.
Through the chair, maybe a verbal warning, but maybe Jeff Edwards could address that. I don't think I have enough background to address that.
So how, I guess, how often are individuals successful in their requests of the parole board? I guess is where I'm
thinking. Representative Thompson, through the chair, Representative Munoz, do you mean the actual offender themselves? Through the chair, I don't believe the offender really drives the requests, and I might be wrong in that, and that could be a question for the executive director. But I believe that comes from parole officers and then working with the board on recommendations.
Thank you.
Further questions at this time? Seeing none, we're going to move on to Jeff Edwards, Board of Parole. Jeff, are you online?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Jeff Edwards, Executive Director for the Parole Board, available for questions.
Yeah, I had a few myself as far as the audit and as far as how are we doing on compliance. We talked about a little bit of them here already today. Board of Parole files not consistent and contain all required information, and it's not been accurate. The recommendation given was executive director should improve procedures to ensure required documentation for parole hearings is accurate and consistently included in parole files. Have you been to accomplish that, been able to get that done?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jeff Edwards, director of the parole board. we believe we have. This is a fairly simple fix for us, and we appreciated the audit team bringing this to our attention. We've been able to solidify our review process of all incoming information. I've directed staff to further and to expand upon the review of information coming in so that our files accurately reflect the information needed for the individual parole board members to make decisions. The way that looks is the department, specifically institutional POs, generate and create the documentation, information necessary for us to make our decision. We receive that information electronically via electronic scan email system, and we catalog as it comes in. And so we've increased the scrutiny of the information coming in, and if we find errors in some of the information that we receive, we send it back and ask that they fully complete the packet so we can have the most up-to-date, accurate information.
Okay. On that subject, I've got the other audit items I'm going to bring up. Pardon?
Go ahead and finish what you have.
Okay. Recommendation number two is that it's on page 1011 of the audit, that the Board of Parole Legislative Audit deal with deficiencies relating to documentation of offender and victim notifications. The problem being that noncompliance with statutory requirements may pose a safety risk to victims. The recommendation was that the executive director, in coordination with the Department of Corrections Management, needs to implement documentation standards to ensure all offenders and victim notifications are made in accordance with statutory requirements. Would you comment on that one, Mr. Edwards?
Sure thing, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jeff Edwards, director of the parole board. This is a big one for us. We went through and did a review, and we found an avenue that we've expanded upon, and that's the documentation in the ACOM system, which is all of our offender information tracking system, and we have access to that system, and so does the entire Department of Corrections. Quite simply, it's a universal information cataloging system that all of Corrections uses, and we have a screen in there that we have access to, and the institutional POs and the field POs also have access to, and they can catalog all victim contact in one of the screens in that system. We've expanded training in that resource to ensure that all departmental employees, to include those POs I just mentioned, were aware of that screen. And so when they have victim contact or when they have a response from a victim regarding a parole hearing, they can catalog that information. And the real recommendation here is for us to document that information that we receive or non-receive. And so that specific window in our ACOM system is specifically dedicated for victim and family contact. And we also increase the characters that folks can write in there. It was real limited before. And at this point, we've increased the number of characters that people can write in the sense of how lengthy the response can be. And so and just so the committee knows, we have, as of late, expanded our victim and victim's family participation into our parole process, and certainly recognizing the importance of the information we receive from the victims and surviving families. We certainly cherish what they have to say in front of the board, recognizing that victimization is certainly one of the most difficult things in our process we have to go through. But we've expanded it to the point where we now offer victim participation in our revocation process, which we did not do before.
So you feel like you're in compliance with the recommendation too?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do.
Okay, I'm going to move on down the line of them here because we got other people with questions. Recommendation 3, changes to the board regulations do not address statutory requirements regarding evaluation of an offender's suitability for parole, nor does it define the methodology used to determine parole suitably. The recommendation is that the board should ensure that proposed regulations address all statutory requirements related to its duties. This includes the identification of a methodology to measure an offender's suitability for discretionary parole. Comment on that one.
It was brought to, thank you, Mr. Chairman, again, Jeff Edwards, Director of the Parole Board. It talked about risk assessment tools. There was a couple questions from committee members a few minutes ago about the risk assessment tools and the accuracy of the scoring instruments. We have recently gone away with some of those complex scoring instruments in which the audit committee found errors in. And we certainly recognize, and the reason why we went away from those specific instruments is because of the complexity of them and the amount of mistakes that we found in those ones. We found it would just be too inaccurate. So we went to a validated risk assessment tool on a national level, has been vetted extensively, and is used by numerous states to determine the risk and the needs of individual offenders. Not only are we using it, but the rest of the Department of Corrections is using that tool to establish risk and needs. So we wanted to marry along with what the rest of the department is using in hopes of being unified in our scoring criteria and also for efficiencies in our process, meaning if the POs and the institution and the field are already using this risk assessment tool, why shouldn't the parole board? So we've moved into the direction, and that risk assessment tool is in the LSIR, and we contemplated and we worked with the Department of Law of whether or not we should put it into our regulation package. And the final recommendation was to not put it into that, into our administrative code that governs our parole process, just out of the worry that at some point in the future the decision may change to use a different risk assessment tool. And recognizing that there's a plethora of other risk assessment tools available out there. But we have committed to working with the Department of Law and figuring out how that would look and putting that into our regulations to meet recommendation number 3.
All right, Mr. Edwards, I'm going to move on to the next recommendation. Was Yes, Representative Gaddis.
May I interject a question at this point? Thank
yes.
you. So if I could be walked through, there's some interesting, the last speaker spoke about the risk assessment tool being utilized by the field, and basically they hadn't quite decided whether the parole board was going to use it or really wanted to put in recommend. But really where I guess that gets, the risk assessment tool used by the field that may or may not be used by the parole, not necessarily, I don't want to go into a big long story. I guess where I'm asking is, if somebody gets picked up and gets taken in, is that when a risk assessment by the field is used? Or do they use it, you know, let's say you get picked up on the street, is that when it's used? And what I'm really trying to get to is that same risk assessment, does it follow you all the way to parole? And then I'm hearing some conversation maybe that says we may use it sometime, we may not. So in the audit, it indicated the risk, we need to use, have some, we need to be, have less ambiguous type of how we use it, when we use it. They got rid of one because maybe it was too complex, but this in itself sounded somewhat complex. So I guess could I just have a brief walk through when this risk assessment gets used and how it carries all the way to the parole?
Mr. Edwards?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, yes, the risk assessment tool is used not only by the parole board, but by the institution and the field agents. So what happens typically on an individual case level is, once a person gets sentenced in his or her case and is served to a period of incarceration, that risk assessment tool is generated by the institutional folks, typically the institutional parole officer, and that assessment is done on the front end, and recognizing that it will identify certain needs of the inmate throughout his period or her period of incarceration. And then that tool follows them along all the way through release from incarceration. Then once released from incarceration, the field PO should or will be doing an updated risk assessment tool. This tool is called the LSIR, Level of Service Inventory Revised. And they will be an updated one once the inmate is released to field supervision and reports to a field probation or parole officer. So you can see that the systematic use of the same tool, so everyone is speaking the same language, seems to help in the efficiency of the process. And so if and when a parolee, for example, violates in the community, the PO, the field PO, who has the updated risk assessment tool, could communicate to the board members who have had training in this tool the amount of risk, what their needs are, kind of their hot topic points, if you will. Is it substance abuse? Is it family related? Is it a housing situation? Is it employment and keeping getting terminated from employment? These are some of the identifying factors in this tool.
Representative Gaddis.
And if I could follow up, and I think that one of the places I was going with this is, if you got arrested, if you will, let's say Friday night, and you were going to bail out on a Saturday, and there was nobody to do a field assessment, is that something that can happen or does happen?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, I'm not quite following your example. I mean, I understand the example, but the tool isn't utilized every time they go in for a violation. It's not reassessed. They're not reassessed. So I'm not quite following your.
Okay, that's fine. I'll follow up. I with some other ways. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Could you tell me how often individuals are granted discretionary, mandatory, or special medical parole? In other words, how often are sure. individuals successful going before the parole board?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Munoz, for discretionary parole, and just for clarification for the committee members, this is for when individuals are asking to be released early from prison. And these people have served some length of time in prison, and they're made their application, and they're asking the parole board for early release, which is different than mandatory parole, which they'll release after serving their sentence. So discretionary ones is where they actually appear before the board, And our grant rate for those, and what I mean by grant rate is the is to actually grant the release, is 66%. So the yes vote is about 66% for discretionary parolees. Mandatory parolees, there was a reference to the graph, I think it was on page 16, and there was a pretty good explanation from the Ledge audit team just a few minutes ago before the committee about the revoke and re-parole. These are for people that are already released onto parole supervision, and they violated their parole. And these four decisions, the continue, revoke and re-parole, revoke and deny, reprimand and warn, those are the four decisions available to the board members when addressing parole violations.
And finally,
Sandy Munoz.
Thank you. On special medical?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we get maybe one or two special medical applications a year. I think we have released, I would say in the last 4 or 5 years, two to three on special medical parole only. The requirements of special medical parole and whether or not an inmate meets those requirements, it's pretty stringent. And so we don't see a lot of applications. These are typically for folks who are, if you will, on their deathbed or nearing the end of life, and we will give them an opportunity to release from prison to spend their final days with family. And so that's usually for terminal cancer patients or people that are bedridden. And so the requirements are real stringent, so we don't see a whole lot of applications for those.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. This is for Mr. Edwards, or if it's dealing with a fiscal note, and so you're not the one that prepared it. It was prepared by the division director, so I don't know if you can answer the fiscal note question. But my question is, in the page one of the audit says that the fiscal year 15 budgeted expenditures were $897,000, $896.7. This fiscal note reflects a
$1 million.
$1,019,400 with five full-time. Is that because there was a vacant parole board officer position in fiscal year 15?
Ms. Milkey, maybe you have the answer to that.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, we only got this fiscal note yesterday, so I contacted the person who prepared it to ask about that, and left a message on her voicemail, and she didn't call me back. So
this bill will be coming back to us.
Thank you.
We will get an answer for that. Okay, Mr. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, recommendation number four was several ACOMS, which is the Alaska Correctional Officers Offender Management System, has deficiencies that were detected that could affect the security and consistency of data contained in the system. And this recommendation was that Department of Corrections Administrative Director should take steps to ensure ACOMS complies with state information technology security standards and national best practices. And this sounds like it's possibly a Department of Corrections compliance, not the Board of Parole that has to worry about this. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jeff Edwards, Director of the Parole Board. Yes, it came about as a result of the audit, and it was directed at the department and the division's admin director. I believe she's on the line. I could take a stab at this answer if you like.
I can ask.
In fact, I believe the department is moving in to fulfill this requirement in recommendation number four, and have implemented new security standards for the ACOM system, which, as I mentioned earlier, is the information tracking system available department-wide, meaning they're going to have where you have to renew your password on a regular basis, you got to change your characters or your password. And so there's four or five different security recommendations that the department is implementing, and in fact, just recently have implemented this in response to number recommendation number four.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. Ms. Curtis from Legislative Audit would like to comment on this and straighten it out.
This is Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor. I just want to caution the board and the department as they address this recommendation that the details of this recommendation were withheld. so they cannot be exploited. So in answering the questions, if you could be general in your assurance and not provide details of the finding, I just wanted to...
Again, this has to do with the Department of Correction. It's not basically the Board of Parole, it looks like. Okay, I'm going to move on from that because let's not delve into that right now. Any further questions of Mr. Edwards while we have him on the line? Representative Sadler.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Question for you, Mr. Edwards, through the chair. There's no increase in funding over 6 years in the fiscal note. Is that a fair assessment that you can continue doing the work for no increase over the next 6 years?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we believe so, although I will say Senate Bill 91 and HB 205 will have a significant impact on the board. And so I guess we'll wait until we see what happens if that leaves and is signed into legislation.
Okay.
Got a Representative Sadler.
Series of questions. Real quick, can you, Mr. Edwards, tell us the staffing on page one of the audit report? Can you tell me which staff are full-time and which are part-time, or if all of them are
full-time? Sure thing. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there's, including myself, six full-time staff, and the parole board members themselves, the five governor-appointed parole board members, who represent various regions throughout the state, are considered to be part-time employees.
Okay.
So, with no benefits, though. They're just, they get paid in our area to include travel and whatnot.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Two more. And travel, there's 83,000 travel. Is that to hold parole hearings at different locations around the state? What do you spend the 83,000 travel for per year?
It's for... when the board members convene, we've been increasing our utilization of telephonic hearings, although difficult. But it is for to move the board members around. For example, we have a representative in Juneau, we have a representative in Fairbanks, a Mat-Su representative in Anchorage, and a Kenai representative. And so, to conduct the business of the board, at times we'll move them around and convene together as a group. And we're somewhat different, although we make the same quasi-judicial system as a superior court judge would. We don't certainly have a dedicated courtroom or room that people, all agencies would convene together with. So we have to essentially move to see the applicants based on the institution and where they're housed at.
So just as a correction, travel is not $83,000. It is $52,200. Yeah, you went down to the services line to get the $83,000.
My apologies. That's correct. I apologize.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And I'll cut to the chase here, Mr. Edwards. Could you get by on one fewer staffer?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that would be very difficult for us to do that. Just by simple, we're a statewide agency, you know, based on the almost 5,000 inmates and thousands of field people on probation or parole. That would be very difficult for us just by the volume of work that comes in.
Representative Sadler.
You said you're increasing use of teleconference. Is there any kind of statutory requirement that when you have a parole hearing, you meet with the parolee or the applicant in person, or can you do that by teleconference?
I don't believe there's anything that statutorily mandates us to meet in person. We do take the decisions obviously very seriously in establishing risk and need, and we do these decisions don't come easily, and we have I'll just say that based on conducting interviews in a face-to-face manner, it gives a whole another aspect of what the inmate's actually talking about in their stories. In addition to the number of victims that we have participate in our hearings, attorneys that participate in the POs. We are trying to do some different creative things to meet to lower our travel line, but it does oftentimes require at least one board member to be in the room to give us some of the feedback that you see when you conduct an actual in-person interview.
Fair enough.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Last two questions, I promise. Question is, would more training to board members or to staff help address the four areas of improvement identified by the legislative audit? Would more training help?
We believe we can adequately, I'll just say we have gone through, and this is one of the big tasks I've directed my staff to do, and we're continuing to do it, is to go on a statewide level to train the institutional POs The board members, we feel, are trained. We do send them to an academy, so to speak, sponsored by the National Institute of Corrections for new board members. And so we feel that training is adequate to the board members. We are, and this, I'll kind of sidebar this a little bit, we've received a scholarship for a national expert on paroling authorities at no cost to the state or my budget line to come up and meet with the board for 2 days to provide targeted areas of training. So we feel we're adequate in the training aspect for board members, but we do continue to reach out and train individual officers around the state.
Thank you. And through the chair, last question at the premise. On page 22 of the audit, there is a discussion of the Clemency Advisory Committee. In your view, Mr. Edwards, should the CAC be eliminated and its functions combined with the parole board?
Oh, boy. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's a good question and a question potentially for the governor's office. It's the governor's program. We're simply tasked with doing the investigation at this point. That could be an option for the governor to ask the parole board to expand their capacity and review clemency applications that has not been asked of the board since I've been with the department for 16 years. But that could be a duty expand, and that would require more time constraints for the board members to conduct those hearings. Currently, the clemency and pardon process has been halted just for a review, as I understand, but that is something that we could definitely look at, but that would be, I think, a question for the administration.
The answer might lie in the fact that it's not been active for 16 years, but thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my apologies for having to step out. But on page 16, could we get numbers for the chart for Exhibit 4? Because percentages really don't help me, you know, to know on the revoke and reparole, you know, 48%, you know, what are those numbers on both sides, so we could better understand whether or not we've got a different kind of problem that's not reflected in these percentages.
Through the chair, certainly we can get that information out to all the board members. I mean, all of the committee members.
If you get that to my staff, we can get them distributed. Follow up, Representative Wilson.
No, I just appreciate that. It's just the way I'm reading it, Mr. Chairman, is that it looks like, you know, we're revoking and reparoling more than we used to. But I know that also is going to be coming before us in the Senate bill. I know that's one of the big issues. That's why so many people are coming back. But I think the numbers will show that to us and allow us to ask better questions that percentages don't always tell you the story.
Further questions of the committee? Well, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, and just to add to that point, factoring in the fact that more and more offenders are nonviolent in nature, so to help make those numbers, which I would agree seem counterintuitive if you look at them just from a number standpoint, have more meaning, I think that additional information would help bring the whole picture together.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Also online, we have April Wilkerson with the Department of Corrections. If anybody has some questions there, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. This would be for April. On the fiscal note question, I don't know if you heard a couple folks were asking, in fiscal year 15, according to the ledge budget and audit, the total of budgeted expenditures were $896.7. This fiscal note says $1,019,400. Can you respond to the difference in the fiscal note 15 versus 17?
Yes. Through the chair, my name is April Wilkerson, and I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. The increase in the difference between the 15 numbers and what is currently reflected in the fiscal note is associated with passage of SB 64 and the PACE parole funding that was received by the parole board.
Representative Kawasaki, follow up.
Okay. And then another question about the fiscal note. The fiscal note reflects 5 full-time positions over to FY22. In the legislative budget and audit, it says that there were 6 positions, and then it said that there was 1 vacancy. And is there a discrepancy between what we got from legislative budget and audit and your fiscal note, or is it because there was a vacancy?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, I believe the fiscal note is incorrect. There should be 6.
Okay.
The fiscal note should be 6?
That is correct.
Okay.
And then one last
Representative
one.
Representative Kawasaki.
This was Representative Sadler's question about fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 22. The line item for personal services is exactly the same. Is that anticipated to be exactly the same? As in there's no raises, none of the folks that are represented in the Board of Parole authorized positions are receiving any extra, what is it, the benefit, the 3.5%, yeah. Right. The
COLA.
COLA and, yeah, merit pay, that's right.
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki. The fiscal note is flat funded based on the sunset allocation and FY17 appropriation, so it does not take into consideration any contractual negotiated changes for future, nor does it take into account any changes in the current practices for the parole board.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think somebody needs to work on that fiscal note. But my question, though, is, has on the probation board where you have it, is there the option of Skyping or any possible face-to-face? Because I do agree that those who have been offended and the offenders, to look at them during their testimony does make sense. But with all the technology we have today, is it possible where you hold these meetings that you would be able to have the face-to-face without actually being there?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Jeff Edwards again of the parole board. That's a possibility. We don't have the infrastructure this time to make that happen. And keep in mind, our parolees are arrested, remanded, or heard for their hearings on a statewide issue, whether it be Savunga to Barrow to Sitka to Dillingham. We have them throughout throughout the state, and certainly remote locations does play a role in doing that. But at this point, we don't have the infrastructure to do it. And to be quite honest, with a calendar of 50 to 60 hearings in a week, to make sure that all parties, to include attorneys, victims, the actual offender, the institution, all five of my board members and my staff to be Skyped is somewhat challenging, not to say it's not impossible.
Follow-up?
Sounds like a broadband problem. Representative Wilson.
Well, I've been to Dillingham. We have a member from Dillingham. I know they can do things like that through the university and other places, so maybe not everywhere. But Skype was just an example, but there's a lot more meetings. I know I've been attending more just using my iPad, and it's got a camera on there, so members having that would still be – you'd still invite everybody. Somebody would still be at that one place. I'm just saying all five members and everyone else. I just – wanting to know if you're looking at that, because I think there's a lot of money savings that's going on there, and still be able to have that face-to-face, because I do agree that talking into a box sometimes doesn't give you the full example, but I think we need to start looking at more technology, and I know it's not everywhere in the state, but I know while you were in Fairbanks it would have been there, so I just want to make sure that we're looking into it.
Okay, any further questions from committee members? Any questions from committee members for the sponsor? Any discussion from the committee? Is hearing none. Seeing no further questions or comments, at this time I'm putting House Bill 231 aside. I want to thank the sponsor. Do you want to have any closing statements on this?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being here. Okay, we'll get ready for our next bill. Give a couple of minutes. We'll do a brief at ease while we get ready for the next bill. All right, we're back on the record, and our next bill to be heard today is House Bill 77, an act relating to training regarding disabilities for police officers, probation officers, parole officers, correctional officers, and the village public safety officers, and relating to guidelines for drivers when encountering or being stopped by a peace officer, relating to driver's license examinations, and relating to a voluntary disability designation on a state identification card and a driver's license. And this was sponsored by myself, by Representative Thompson. First, we have a committee CS.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill Number 77, version 29-LS0072/N, dated 12/2/15, as a working document for committee referral.
Okay, we have the CS before us at this time. I will have my staff, Jane Pearson, present the bill. Ms. Pearson, please come to the table and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Hi, for the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. This bill has sort of been a work in progress. It really was brought to us by one of our disability groups in Fairbanks called Wallbusters. And they have really been the driving impetus, and it has been one of those things when you work with constituents that is very satisfying. The goal of HB 77 is to improve communications between law enforcement professionals and other agencies who interact with people who have non-apparent disabilities, whether they encounter the system as victims, witnesses, or alleged perpetrators. Hidden or non-apparent disabilities are those physical or mental impairments that are not readily apparent to others. They include such conditions as intellectual disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, mental health conditions, epilepsy, hearing impairments, FASD, autism, post-traumatic stress disorder, and a number of other disorders. HB 77 has three components. The first component is identification on an Alaska State ID or driver's license. It would institute a voluntary statewide identification system that would discreetly inform officials that individuals with whom they are interacting have a hidden disability. This is, you have in your packet a picture of a blue and white symbol. That is what we are looking to have put on the driver's license. It would be similar to an organ donor mark or a veteran's mark on a license. The participation would be voluntary, so somebody would have to apply for it. It would be by a doctor, nurse, or PA order, so you could not just go out and get this mark on your license without a medical okay. And if an individual chose, they could put a more visible indicator on their car, on their person, whatever. So it also has a training component. This was taken out of the bill when it passed through House State Affairs. It is very important to the Wallbusters people that this stay in the bill is a statutory, because they are afraid if it is regulatory, it could fall out. And basically how it reads in the bill is that for training, the curriculum requirements established under this paragraph must include training in recognizing people with disabilities, appropriate interactions and resources available to persons with disabilities, and the requirements to conform with Title II of the American with Disabilities Act. So this has gone back into the bill, and it is the difference between the version that passed out of State Affairs and the version before you today. So the third part of the bill is an inclusion in the driver's manual of a section on the duties and responsibilities of drivers when encountering or being stopped by a police officer. And this is probably something I know when I see that those red and blue lights behind me, my heartbeat rises. I become scared, basically. I don't know what the encounter will going to be. This is basic, simple. It doesn't go into what is legal and what isn't. It would be about pulling over when it is appropriate, what documentation you have to provide to the officer, and just some basic understanding of how the interaction should proceed. And this is kind of timely because the Ninth Circuit has held for the first time that Title II of the Americans with Disability Act is applicable to arrests and police investigations. So I think the folks from Wallbusters, when they testify, can give you a little bit more information on this. And there are some, when we work this through, that people with hidden disabilities can face many disadvantages when interacting with criminal justice system. They may not want their disability to be recognized and try to hide it. They may not understand their rights but pretend that they do. They may not understand commands. They may be overwhelmed by the presence of authority. They may have trouble processing or remembering information. They may not follow instructions and may be perceived as belligerent or unmotivated. There may be a low level of frustration causing him or her to act out in anger. They may not be able to understand why they are being detained and try to run away or become upset and combative. There may be difficulty remembering and describing details. They may not understand what they are agreeing to, and they may be easily persuaded. And they may eagerly confess in order to please those around them. So this indication on the driver's license is meant to set up communications when people are first stopped, arrested. And that is basically the gist of the bill. And I think there are some of the Wallbusters folks are online, and they can fill you in on how and why this bill came around. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
We have quite a bit of invited testimony, but first, is there any questions from the committee? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Jane, is this voluntary, so that if people who do have these disorders, or, you know, if they don't go up to DMV, they don't get into trouble because they didn't indicate that they had these disorders, so it's a voluntary program?
Representative Newman, through the chair, it is totally voluntary. There is no demand that anybody has to do this. So it is totally voluntary.
Follow up, Representative Newman.
A couple of questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So also, I had just recently had a discussion with Captain Hans Brinke at B Detachment in Palmer, and he had just gone through a program that taught Alaska State Troopers on how to identify people who might have psychological disorders. Because in an instance, they have to try and decide, is this person trying to kill me, or is they just have a problem? So is this basically the same training that the troopers receive already, so there's an established curriculum?
Representative Newman, through the chair, that is correct. I know that the Wallbusters people were very involved when this curriculum was being set up last summer, and I believe Bob Griffiths is online, and he is in charge of the training, and he can probably fill you in as to what is there, but they do have an exceptionally good training at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicated that the state affairs pulled the training aspect from the bill. What reason did they give for pulling the training portion?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair. The training portion, they were in the process of writing the regulations at that time, so we pulled that out, and I know that the Wallbusters folks did work with the people that were developing the training, and they have done a really good job, and the regulations are very good that they have now. The reason we put it back in was basically there was some concern that if it was in regulation, it may fall out. And if it was in statute, it would be there to be offered to conform with Title II.
So what I'm hearing you say is the bill sponsor pulled it out and then put it back in. So it's the bill sponsor worked through that.
Representative Gaddis, that is correct.
That's what I just want to clarify. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. I think I might have answered the question. In Section 2, it's the part that it does talk about voluntary, which is good. And that if the disability is cognitive, mental, neurological, or physical disability. And then my question was whether that at some point in time, if it was a cognitive or mental or some sort of disability that went away, it's not a permanent disability, that a person could take their name off. It looks like it should provide a means. The next line says provide a means by which a person can cancel the designation. Would that mean that it's permanently off a record, or will it always become part of a person's personal record when in absent?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, this does not relate to absent. This would be on your driver's license, not an absent, which is done through the Department of Public Safety.
But
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But don't, I mean, when a person's pulled over, licenses taken out, I mean, isn't that the backup that they've got for understanding what a person's got on their record? Like, concealed carry is not on my license, but the state recognizes I have a concealed carry permit. They know right away because it's part of their system.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I am not an expert on ASPN, but I believe that may be something that is added to ASPN. And I believe we have Lieutenant David Hansen online, and he might be able to give you more information as to what ASPN is and what's on there.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Section 4 and 5 relate to some new language discussing specifically the duties and responsibilities of drivers when encountering or being stopped by a peace officer. What are those duties? Are those somewhere cited in statute currently, or are they regulation?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. I think the duty is to pull over when you can safely do so and to make sure you have your license, your registration, and your insurance card there. As far as other duties, you may get into some things that are legally challenged one way or the other, and I don't think we want to get into that. I think this will be the basics.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know exactly what the duties and responsibilities are. I kind of understand them to be if I see red and blues coming on in my I do pull over at a certain time. But at the same time, I was pulled over one time and I didn't have a safe place to pull over, and the cop admonished me for not pulling over right away. I said I didn't have a safe place to stop. And so I guess if there's some sort of definitional language somewhere in statute or within regulation, I'd be more comfortable with this language.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And mine kind of goes on the back of Section 4 and Section 5. So I'm trying to figure out how there's a zero fiscal note if we're going to change the test and we're going to add things to the book. Where does that happen?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we rewrite the book every year. So it would just be added to the book and the test. It wouldn't be that we'd all of a sudden have to redo the book because this passed. When the next time the book comes out, this would be added to the book.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So back to, a safe place, and I've had those same kind of encounters where it's been really dark and you want to make sure you're underneath the light because you hope that those lights are real, and we've been shown that sometimes they're not. Will that just go through those new questions that will be on the test, and that part that's put in the manual, will that just go through the DMV process? Will that be in regulation where there'll be a comment period? How is that going to be exactly done, if you know at this point?
Representative
Troopers and the Department of Motor Vehicles online to answer questions also.
Yeah, and Representative Wilson, through the chair, I did talk with Kelly Howell about this yesterday, and I think you may get some better answers through Lieutenant David Hansen. And also, we talked about this being the basics. It would not be – I don't think it would come through regulation. It would be added to the driver manual, and we would work through the troopers.
This time we can go to Amy Erickson from the Division of Motor Vehicles. I think she's online. Yes, she is. Ms. Erickson, are you there?
For the record, this is Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. for many of the things, or all of the things that are on our driver's knowledge test, it is set by statute, but we can very easily just insert a question about this into our knowledge testing system without putting it into statute.
Ms. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Erickson, I was just, you know, just the process portion of it, and it probably happens in other areas, you know, like insurance and all. So to put this in the manual, is that done by just a regular process by the DMV, or does it go out for public comment in a regulatory type of fashion?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, we would just take the language and insert it ourselves and send it to the printer.
Okay, thank you. And I think it's good, Mr. Chairman, because I think there always is a question on what the proper protocol is in every state. I was just more curious about how specific it's going to get in, and then if you get pulled over and you don't do it exactly the way the book says, whether that will cause another problem.
I feel even probably young people that just get their driver's license don't know the procedure should they get stopped. So this is a good thing to have in print. Mm-hmm. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on page 4, I'm not particularly concerned about that. Duties and responsibilities, unless you intend something different, and Ms. Pearson, you can tell me if you intend something different, but duties and responsibilities to me would be those things that are defined by law, and if the department doesn't know what those things are, then we've got a bigger problem. But I don't think that there's anything that would be a duty or a responsibility that isn't already in the law right now.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I agree with you.
Thanks.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I've got a series of questions with your permission.
Okay.
I think following up Representative Kawasaki's question, Jane, would a designation of a disability record be kept anywhere if should the condition justifying the disability determination go away, like a broken leg or something like that? I think he asked the question, if it would remain in APSIN, you said no, it would not remain in APSIN. Would it be retained anyplace else, like in DMV's records?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that is not something I have thought through, nor would I know, seeing that we are requiring a letter to get the designation. I imagine that might stay in your DMV file, but that would have to be a question I think you'd ask Amy Erickson from DMV.
Okay. Let's do that for
you. Erickson, did you hear that question?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think it would, if it goes into DMV's system, Alvin, it would or could go into APSIN. It's possible that we could restrict it from going into APSIN if that were your desire.
Okay.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Moving on to another question. On page 1, line 13, this is for Ms. Pearson, you talk about the who shall have the power to make a disability determination, physician, physician assistant, advanced nurse practitioner, licensed psychologist. Do those professions have the ability to designate a person as having a disability for any other purpose? For example, a handicapped parking space or any other purpose?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe they are the same list of people that would do the designated. But again, if we could ask Ms. Arison on that, I would feel more secure than answering it off the top of my head.
Already in statute, basically, though, for disability, for physical disability. I mean, you know.
Yes. Amy.
Ms. Erickson, do you have that question?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. The question is, is the list of people who, under this law, would be allowed to designate someone as a disability for the purposes of a driver's license or ID, that being a physician or physician assistant, advanced nurse practitioner, or a licensed psychologist, are those do those folks have the same ability to designate a disability for any other purpose, such as for a handicapped parking space? Placard?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, they do indeed.
Okay. Good deal.
Thank
you. Just by way of information, I know that there are some other definitions of disability. I've got a bill that for ABLE accounts that would allow someone with a disability. And it's a little stricter standard, but that's interesting. A general question, I guess, for Jane. I'll try again there. This bill focuses primarily on drivers of motor vehicles. I just wonder how many people might have a disability who are still eligible to drive a motor vehicle. I know disability has a broad range of definitions, both psychological, neurological, and physical. I just wonder how many people I guess the question is, how many folks might likely get a designation on an ID card or driver's license who don't drive?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I don't know, but we'd also have it for the – the bill also includes ID cards, too.
And last question, sir?
Representative Sadler.
I think. This is actually for Amy. By way of background, we had a I had a bill a couple of years ago to put a veteran's designation on the driver's license, and it was extraordinarily expensive. It had a heck of a fiscal note. Amy, what's happened in the past 3 years that it's, there's no fiscal note for that?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we've now switched over to central issuance, and we have a new vendor that produces our cards. So I'm told this is actually a very simple change for us now.
Damn that progress. Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Amy, if you don't mind, I visited the DMV last year and had the chance to find out all the details on the wall over the 2 hours that I was there. But in the process of the discussion with the young man that was on the other side of the desk, he mentioned that you weren't printing the manuals anymore. Is that true? And if that's the case, then why are we putting in statute another thing to put in manuals if you guys aren't actually printing them?
Through the chair, is it Representative Pruitt that was speaking?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. We do still print some of the manuals. We've lightened up the printing by about a third, but they are still produced in hard copy as well as online.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you for that clarification. He also had some ideas, by the way. You've got some bright people that work for you that have ideas on how to make the DMV more efficient, more effective, and I'd encourage you to communicate with them. I actually have the young man's card in my car still, and he had some ideas on how to limit people abusing, losing their license and those kinds of things. So maybe one point in time I might act on some of those, but you've got some great people that work for you. I do want to highlight, though, I want to continue to ask, we're talking a little bit about the accessing of these records, and of course, first thing that goes through my mind is HIPAA concerns. They're going to come to you, they've got information about their disability, and we're going to place it into the system. What are the barriers of being able to access that system so that we do not have potential abuse or people that really shouldn't be viewing certain records and learning potentially information about people's health? What limitations do we have to prevent that from happening?
I'm sorry, is that question for me?
Yeah, I'm assuming unless there's someone else that deals with
through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I understood that we wouldn't necessarily have someone disclose what their disability was. It would just be that they had a disability that they cared to put this indicator on their license.
Okay, I must have misunderstood. Mr. Chair, I must have misunderstood the earlier conversation. I thought it sounded like and that there was going to be it was going to be somehow recorded in some capacity. I must have misunderstood it. So what we're just you just have to come in and show something, and we'll go ahead and put it on. We'll put this little designation on the license. Do they have to come back and prove it the next time they get their license? I mean, what if it's temporary? How do we deal? I mean, right now, if we can give the placards that are temporary for someone to be able to park in a location, but if someone has maybe a temporary concern they're concerned about, how do we deal with that scenario?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, because it's voluntary, I don't see that it would be an issue if someone wanted to have that indicator, even if it's for a short time. I don't see the harm.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair. Yeah. I might be able to help out on this a little. On page 3, lines 11 through 14, it discusses for a replacement of a valid identification card with a new identification card with a disability designation, the department may charge a fee of $5 for replacement card and a disability designation with a new identification card without a disability designation.
Okay.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, actually, and I'll just, since we're talking about it, by the way, that young man that I talked about at the DMV actually highlighted the fact that we only charge $5. He said he's had people come in 6 or 7 times to replace their card, and we charge them $5 every time, and he said maybe we should create an encouragement for them to hold on to their IDs. That's just something to consider. It was from that young man from the DMV. Okay, thank you for that. Mr. Chair, I guess the last thing that I'll highlight that I've got to, because there's two parts to this bill. There's the discussion about the license, and then there's just section four and five, which don't seem to have any purpose. I mean, in terms of there's not a connection to why is it there compared to the rest of the bill. And so my concern is if we're going to talk about the duties and responsibility of drivers, and we're going to actually place, when being stopped by a police officer, we're going to actually place it on the test. Coming from my district, what about the rights of the individual that's being stopped? Should that also be on the test? Should we have both of those pieces being on there?
Ms. Pearson.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the reason we chose just to go this way is there are a lot of questionable areas, having done criminal law, that some people will tell you have to get out of the car, some people won't. They'll say that's not your right. So this is not what your rights aren't. This is the basics, what everybody has to do. I don't think we want to get into that sort of discussion. I mean, that's left for the legal folks. Yeah.
Well, but, Mr. Chair, but we're writing law. So, I mean, to say that we shouldn't get into the legal discussion, we are writing law. I don't know that actually is an unacceptable answer to say that we shouldn't get into the legal discussion when we are writing law. So I guess I'll go back to the question. If we're going to talk about duties and responsibilities and we're going to ask one question on the test, which I think is what I heard Amy say, and if I understood that incorrectly, please correct me. She said we can just easily add a question. That's really not going to answer all of the things that are responsible, the responsibility of an individual when being detained. So I guess it's still, what's the real goal? I think that's what I'm trying to make sure that I accomplish in this, is I'm trying to make sure that I understand why these two sections are in here. I get the other sections, and it's making sure that we have that appropriate communication, I totally understand it. This part, I'm trying to understand the full, what are we trying to accomplish? Because we are writing law. There is a legal point to it. If we're going to talk about one piece of it, which is the duties and responsibilities of the driver, then we can't neglect the rights of the individual as well.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I think I understand your question better now. This developed, we got to talking in this group that we've been working this bill, and this part came in later. And it came about really because there was discussion of, okay, the lights are behind you. What do you do?
Setting new precedents.
Yeah, it isn't setting new precedents. It isn't going into describing legally what your rights or rights aren't. It is the very basic what you do to make sure that there is safety in a pull and a stop.
And Representative Newman has a comment on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand the question, too, because the bill does not do anything with Section 4. That's put in there when these bills are written through legal, they add up this other information in there so that you know what the Alaska statutes are. In Section 4, it has to do with the publishing of the manual. Section 5, it states that the sentence that has to be added, but I don't believe the sponsor is trying to change anything in Section 4. I don't see anything in bold there. And then just in Section 5, it has this, just when in... So you're not adding subsections or sections. You're just adding a sentence in there. But in Section 4, that's just already statute. It talks about the manual. And it's included there as informative. I know that many of these bills, tend to include existing statutes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, no, or maybe I'm reading wrong. Section 4 actually adds a subsection. And I guess what's the crux of this? If we've gone for so many years without having something in our manual, why is it we're determining now that there's a problem? Are we having problems with people when they're being pulled over with our police officers? Is this a real problem that we're searching for the solution, or are we, I mean, is this kind of a feel-good thing? I mean, I'm not a fan of just filling up books. I want to make sure that there is a real reason for adding statute. I guess that's
Jenny Pruitt. One of the reasons that this was brought forward is because of some actions that have taken place in the past. We have a person that has a slurred speech, that doesn't communicate well. A police officer might think that they are drunk. Tell them to get out of the car. They are nervous because they don't know what to do because they've never been stopped before, and they're kind of belligerent. They get drug out of the car when they have not been drinking. There's nothing wrong with them. This is trying to make sure that the police officers understand that they have a driver's license with a designation that they have a problem,
right,
and that they understand what they're supposed to do when they get stopped. You produce your driver's, things like that, and show them your driver's license that has that on it. Ms. Pearson, do you want to follow up on that?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I think he's absolutely right, and I work with somebody who got pulled over for the first time and didn't know what to do and got herself into a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. So I think this is just, it's knowledge that is good for people to have, and if it's a missing piece of knowledge, this is a great place to offer it in the driver's manual.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Edgman, on that subject, because we got everybody here.
On that subject, it would seem to me that with a neurological spectrum sort of ever-increasing, and we've got, maybe the vice chair could speak more articulately to this, but we know more the autism spectrum itself, the degrees. I'm thinking of Asperger syndrome, of other things, where you have adults who are fully functioning in one hand, but on another hand, maybe are on the scale, whereas in years past they weren't on the scale. I also think about fetal alcohol syndrome and the prevalence of that in rural Alaska, and I'll save my question regarding that later, but. I mean, those thoughts pop into my mind when I hear this discussion, and I think this bill addresses more of an evolution of things than it does anything else.
Thank you, Representative Edmund.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to—I totally get this part, and then this part, I'm trying to connect it to the other piece, and so that helped me connect it because I'm trying to figure out why we're adding this piece. This part I understood, and. Trying to make sure, but the goal is it's not to re-educate the normal person, because we've got challenges in certain communities throughout, and I've been able to, and a friend of mine is a Missourian representative in Missouri for Ferguson. And I've talked to him a lot about some of these challenges. And so I was trying to connect all these dots. The goal here is to make sure that individuals that have the, if I understand it right, that have this, they know how to present it because they get flustered. It's not because we've got other challenges where we need to look at the rights of the individuals that fully comprehend what's being done. Right?
Right.
Okay. So that's what I'm trying to, I would just need to make the connection, what those were there, why we're doing it, and I think I understand now. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson, did you have your hand up? No? Yes?
Well, I did. Yeah, on
Gaddis, Garab, Wilson was first, I think.
Yeah.
I got you in the queue.
Thank you. And my question more, it's at the beginning of this. Mr. Chairman, I thought when someone had a disability and they brought the documentation in, I thought it was more important that is documented somewhere, because depending upon what, somewhere private, I mean, that's why the whole part of having something very simple on there, because for CDLs, you have to, so I know that the DMV can secure medical records because you have to take your medical records in if you want a CDL, so I'm not worried about that part of it. But my concern is, so you get a driver's license and the officer sees that on there, it just seems to me it would be a benefit for that officer to know what the disability is, because for many, you can't see the disability. That's the issue. And so I guess I'm trying to find out why we would not have that information for officers. To me, that's what made the second part of the bill, is so that they would know that if they had PS, you know, if they, you know, if it was an officer that came back that had those kind of issues, or if they had, you know, they were on pain medication or had, you know, whatever it happens to be, for each one of those disabilities, you would react differently. So just to have that on there, I think it helps us better than nothing. But I guess my curiosity is why we wouldn't have it in the system for the officer.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. We really didn't want to get into HIPAA law, and we didn't want to get into anything. I think, that, you know, show me your license, your ID, your insurance card. Oh, I see you have a mark on here for a hidden disability. Do you want to talk about that? That's the sort of communication we're trying to open. I imagine if somebody gets pulled over multiple times, it will show up on their Aspen, because that's how things get onto Aspens, you know, that somebody is recognized.
Oh, no.
I have not known, and it was the first time I heard talking with Amy, that this could go onto somebody's Aspen. I'm not exactly sure how that will work, but I certainly will find out before this bill comes before you again. You know, I don't think we wanted to identify everybody and their disorders, and that was not the list we wanted to keep. And there was some advantages and disadvantages to that. But I think, you know, if we start compiling what everybody's disabilities are, that's a problem, too.
A follow-up?
Representative Newman had a comment on that, and we'll come back to you.
Thank you. Particularly on that point, that's one of the biggest issues I have with the prescription drug database, is we've got the state of Alaska collecting very personal information, medical information on Alaskans. And to me, that's about the last thing we want to be doing. You know, if they want to identify that they have a disability, they can discuss with the police officer, that's fine. But for the state to start keeping track of an individual physical disabilities and what they are, I really have problems with that.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the story that you relayed is a story that I told the group, so and I'll just relay it. So it was a military personnel. If you look at him, everything looks normal. Once he gets stopped by anybody, authority, he goes into this mode that sometimes he can't even explain what's going on because, as you explained, was a stop. So since this is voluntary, is there not a possibility that if I want it to be shared because I can't, you know, relay that during those kinds of situations, that at least that would be an option? Because I'm just, you know, I mean, I'm a sponsor of this bill. I like the bill, you know, and I like it that it's voluntary. But I would think that if somebody knows that when they get in a situation like that, and this person has been stopped multiple times, mm-hmm. so he has a record for it. Every time he's had to go and show the legal medication and the doctor's things and everything else in the court, and it's cost him thousands of dollars, spent 3 days in jail once because of it, for it to be cleared. So it's a huge issue. But I'm just thinking he would have gone through pretty much the same thing, because the notice would have said he had a disability, but it would still have been very difficult for the officer to know. So I can see maybe you wouldn't want to mandate it, just so you know we're doing tons on CDLs, we're taking we should be so concerned by them as well as we do here, but to have the option, I guess, for the person to be able to say, I want to go there or not in a box, I think it's just worth maybe just asking, because, again, the whole point is to make sure that we don't re-traumatize someone, you know, already that has a disability, and I just think that would put them at a disadvantage, Mr. Chairman. But maybe it's voluntary versus mandatory.
And Representative Wilson, through the chair, Lieutenant David Hansen may be a better person to ask for that. I am not exactly sure how things get onto Aspen. I am not privileged to get onto Aspen. And, you know, I imagine if somebody has been pulled over multiple times and there have been issues, it will show up on Aspen. But I'm not sure. You might want to ask the lieutenant.
Through the chair.
Representative Wilson.
The point is it does. It does show up, and so it looks like he's a multiple offender. When the other part doesn't show is that when he's gone to court, he has shown all the paperwork, has been dropped, but that's completely separate. And that is my concern, is it does show up on there, and that wouldn't help those people who, once they get stopped, aren't able to be able to then verbalize what their issue is. So, and I'll ask that, and like I said, maybe it's not mandatory, but at least the people would have an option who have that type of disability and know that they would get into that issue.
And Representative Wilson, through the chair, I understand what it is, but I don't think that was the point of this bill. But we can work on it if it's important to you.
We've got quite a few questions yet, and we have some invited testimony, so we can keep them short if we can. Representative Guerra, and then Representative Gaddis.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess we can find out about absent, but my recollection is that if you've been convicted, it says you've been convicted. If you haven't been convicted, it doesn't say you've been convicted. So there's no, I don't think there's any danger that if you've been pulled over and it's a, and there's nothing that says you've been convicted, that the person will think you've committed a crime, that the police officer will think accidentally think you've committed a crime. So unless I hear something else, I'm not really worried about the absent system. It's pretty clear. I think a number of us had a bill like this. I think either introduced or withdrew when I found out you did. You had filed it, and I didn't have the sentence that Representative Pruitt has noted on page 4. So I was curious about it. But I think if the purpose of the bill is to protect people who have a disability, or let's say they're hard of hearing. Let's use the example of somebody who's hard of hearing. We don't want them being treated like they're a drunk person where they're not drunk. That's the purpose of the bill. We don't want them manhandled when they've done nothing wrong. And so on one hand, the beginning of the bill talks about the responsibilities of the police officer to try and so they will learn that there are conditions people have that are not drunkenness, that they shouldn't be treated like they're a criminal. And then page 4, I think, then supplements that protection by testing the driver. So the driver pays a little more attention to that part of the manual that already exists. So they can also take an extra half a step to minimize the chance that they're going to be manhandled. So it's consistent, I think, with the purpose of the bill. On one hand, you want officers to understand that people have conditions that may at first look like drunkenness that are not drunkenness. We want to protect them. And on the second hand, you want the driver to be able to help with that if possible. This isn't mandatory. They're not going to get arrested if they don't know all the duties and responsibilities of being a driver. But it'll minimize the chances also that something untoward will happen during the stop. So I think this provision is fine. It doesn't take away anybody's rights. If you forget that you were tested on this part, there's no penalty on you. It just minimizes the chance there's going to be a bad stop, and I think that's what we're trying to do. So I'm fine with this provision. I wasn't at first. As I was listening to the questions, I was agreeing with Representative Pruitt, but the more I thought about it, I think this part of the bill actually will minimize the problem. It'll minimize the problem that we're trying to avoid. So I'm okay with it.
Out of respect for the public that have been waiting on the phones for quite a while to testify, the invited testimony, I would like to go through a few people here and let them get their testimony in so that they aren't going to call back and wait in a future meeting. So then we'll come back to more questions from the committee. First, I'm going to go to Juanita Webb from Wallbusters. Juanita, are you online?
I am. Thank you.
Yeah, if we could all hold our testimony fairly short so we can get through this. Go ahead, Juanita.
Yes.
Identify yourself and your connection.
I am Juanita Webb. I live in Fox, Alaska, and I am here today on behalf of Wallbusters and myself. And I would like to respectfully let Representative Pruitt know that I am a normal person with a disability. Approximately in 2014, I was involved in an incident where state troopers were called to a home where there was an ongoing emotional situation. And the troopers were told up front that one of the parties involved had a disability and that they needed to introduce themselves and let this person know what they were doing or what their intention was doing because of the disability that this person had. The state troopers never did this. And knowing the personality of this person, had I not stepped in and let this person know what was happening, I know that it could have very easily escalated, especially when one of the troopers put his hand on his service revolver. He did not draw it, but the person with a disability didn't necessarily know what the actions, what was going to happen next. So obviously I'm speaking to the training part of this bill. So like I said, I would have been afraid of what might have happened if I had not been there to speak to the person with the disability and let him know what was going on. we, as Wallbusters, have asked for standardization across the state. There's currently three different academies. There's Sitka, Fairbanks, and Anchorage, where there's two different academies. And although some of them have been have great programs, and they've worked with us over the last 3 years on their programs, they are not standard across the state. And if we had the ability to make it standardized across the state, then the residents of Alaska, whether disabled or not, would know what the expectation is and what to expect, as well as the people in this line of work, the law enforcement, is, as they moved around the state, that they would know that the standard was the same across the state as well. This Wallbusters, as James stated earlier, is a kind of a grassroots organization, and it is made up of a bunch of normal people with disabilities that have put this bill together. We appreciate your time and your efforts on this, and are asking you to please pass the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webb, and thank you for your brevity. We've got several more invited testimony. Rick Webb, are you online?
I am.
Yes, identify yourself, and we'll hear your testimony.
I'm Rick Webb. Live in Fox, Alaska, and I am would like to welcome you to my world, because I understand there's no cameras where you can see me. I'm a blind individual. And anyway, I would like to speak in support of HB 77 and its importance. And I was asked to tell a story, and I've heard so many. And I was trying to figure out which one to tell, and I finally decided I'm going to tell the same one that I told Representative Thompson summer of 2013. And that really is what kind of started all the stories that started coming in. And anyway, it was springtime in Fairbanks, chilly. A young lady that is deaf was at a party. The party ended. There had been alcoholic beverages there. Walking out to her car, she decided that she probably should not drive right away, and just to make sure that she was sober enough to drive. And as I mentioned, it was chilly, so she started her car, climbed into the back seat, locked her car, and fell asleep. And it happened to be on Fort Wainwright. Military police noticed the vehicle running for extended time, went over to investigate, noticed a person in the back, knocked on the window. Of course, there was no response because she's deaf. Anyway, so they unlocked the car and reached in, grabbed a hold of her by the leg, you know, didn't, not pulling or anything, just, you know, reached in, you know, touched her to see, you know, she was alive. Of course, that woke her up, startled. She was in fear, thinking she was being attacked. She reacted, and then she was drug out of the car and restrained, all because she couldn't hear the instructions of the law enforcement. She couldn't see that they were officers because of the being nighttime, flashlights in her eyes, can't see what you know, who it is. And anyway, needless to say, she ended up with five felonies, including assaulting an officer, drunken driving, and a couple others. And then she went, was assigned a brand new public defender, and got some bad advice. And rather than fight the charges, she pleaded guilty to all of them and ended up with numerous fines, and is now cannot live on her own because in order to pay the fines with her small income, she can't afford rent or to feed herself. And so she now lives with family down in California, I believe. And that's just one story. Little bit of knowledge on law enforcement's part could have had a completely different result, that interaction. And like I said, that's just one story. So I just, I thank all of the co-sponsors and Representative Thompson for their attention to this issue and this bill, and I encourage you to pass HB 77. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick, very much. Next, we're going to go to Kathy Gerby from Access Alaska. Kathy?
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Gerby, and I'm the Director of Independent Living for Access Alaska, and I am here in support of HB 77. One of our normal consumers named Audrey experienced a significant traumatic brain injury and had engaged in intensive rehab for a lengthy period of time. For some people who have experienced a traumatic brain injury, stress can reduce their capacity to express themselves clearly. Audrey had successfully passed her driving test and could drive again. Despite her success, Audrey was still a little nervous about driving. One day after a meeting, Audrey became confused at a turn and ended up going around a roundabout several times. An officer saw her and signaled Audrey to pull over. Audrey was already stressed because she felt lost, and she became increasingly stressed as she pulled over for the police officer. The officer asked for Audrey's license and her insurance, and Audrey said to the officer with some level of stress in her voice, "You need the card, you need the card, you need the card." The officer politely responded, "Ma'am, please give me your license and your insurance." Audrey, with increasing stress, began shouting, "The card, the card." The officer asked Audrey to step out of her car. By that time, Audrey had found her license, her insurance, and the card. The card was actually the business card of the Access Alaska Brain Injury Advocate. The card read that Audrey was a consumer of the advocate and that she experienced a traumatic brain injury, and because of this injury, Audrey may need additional time to answer questions if she is stressed. The card had the name and phone number of the independent living advocate to contact if further support was required. The officer allowed Audrey a moment, and following a dialogue, things resolved themselves without a problem. Later that same day, the officer contacted the advocate at Access Alaska and told them what happened, and thanked them for the note in the back of Audrey's card, as it was very helpful to him. What the officer didn't know was that Audrey had also called the advocate to meet for coffee. Audrey was very upset, believing she had done something wrong because she was pulled over. The advocate supported Audrey with further discussion about the phone call from the officer and additional skill development regarding self-advocacy when stopped by the police. Audrey would elect to have a symbol placed on her license to support herself and an emergency responder to know that she experiences a disability and may need additional time or support under times of stress. Please support the safety and well-being of our citizens through passing HB 77 to maximize the opportunity for positive outcomes for our hardworking police officers and for people with disabilities. And to all of you for the hard work that you are doing during this session especially, our sincere thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gerby. Next, we're going to go to Sarah Heeb, Alaska Police Standards Council Administrative Investigator. Sarah, are you still online?
No, I'm
not. Oh, you're in the audience. Very nice. Please place yourself on the record.
For the record, I'm Sarah Heeb, Administrative Investigator for the Alaska Police Standards Council. I don't have any prepared testimony. I was here for questions regarding this bill. And my boss, the Executive Director, Bob Griffiths, is unfortunately in a hearing today and is unable to attend, so I'm here for him.
I have a question then about the police standards. Where do they stand on having this in statute compared to regulation?
Well, when I came here today, I was under the impression that the training portion had been removed from the bill, but I don't understand the legislative process entirely. So I see that apparently it's back in.
Yes.
I was told... I'm not talking loud enough? Okay. The council's long supported training of officers on disability awareness and currently has regulatory changes out for public comment that will mandate basic training, including 8 hours of disability awareness. The same regulations will require 8 hours of training in recognizing and dealing with the emotionally disturbed individuals, which is different but related to disability awareness. We have currently proposed and published language dealing with police officer training in the public comment process. The council intends to publish similar regulation changes for corrections to comment on in March with the target adoption for both the police regulation changes and the correction regulation changes in May. In fact, that's what I'm supposed to be doing this afternoon, getting them out for public comment. The council feels that the public safety training and certification mandates, such as those contained in this bill, are best done in regulation rather than statute. Current language in Alaska Statute 1865-220 provides the powers and authority for the Alaska Police Standards to make those regulatory changes, which can be done more efficiently to address and identify training need than by amending statutes. And in short, we feel that the council is already addressing this issue and that using the rigidity of statute change is not as advantageous as a more flexible regulatory process.
I hope you can understand why we have put it back in. With our fiscal situation, we could end up cutting funding for training to where that they would maybe have to change things and not train officers in this respect. So this would make sure that we get it done. This is our concern. It isn't a lot different than what you're doing. This is just putting it in the statute so that it makes sure that it continues to be done. Do you understand that part?
I do understand that it's either going to be a statute or a regulation. So I do understand that.
Okay. Questions from committee? Yes, Representative Pruitt.
So if we make this statute, not regulation, how difficult is it for you later on if you feel that you need to go above and beyond? There's more you need to add to this. How difficult does it make it for you to be able to do that if we've placed it in statute instead of giving you the ability to do it through regulation?
Let's see. It's Representative Pruitt through the chair?
Yes.
Okay. If we want to go above and beyond what you've put into statute, we have the ability to do that. Most of our academies right now go twice the length of the regulation requirement that we have. So they do above and beyond what the base requirement is. So we have the ability, the academies have the ability to go above and beyond what the statutory minimums would be.
So I guess I need to understand it. So what is your resistance to it being a statute then as opposed to regulation?
It's a statutory language right. Well, what I just read from my boss. I apologize. I didn't realize it was back in, so I'm a little bit blindsided by that. My understanding was I was going to be here to say that we're doing this in regulation, so it's not needed to be in statute. So that's what my understanding was. It's in one. I know statute is the law and regulation is also the law, so having it in both spots seems
redundant.
So I imagine that's one of our reasons that we're already addressing it, or actually putting it into regulation now, so it's not needed to be in statute since it's being redundant.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next I'm going to have Art Delane from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. He's also a member of Wallbusters. Mr. Delane, Art, are you there?
Yes, I am. And thank you for allowing me to testify in front of the committee today. My name is Art Delane. I live in Fairbanks, and like Representative Thompson said, I am a member of Wallbusters, deeply involved in this bill. And I am, the governor's council has asked me to speak on their behalf as I am a member. Alaskans with disabilities, especially those disabilities that aren't readily recognized, deserve to be treated fairly and respectfully by police officers, corrections officers, and parole or probation officers. Sometimes recognizing that that person has a disability can be challenging. Disability awareness training will first help an officer to realize that some individuals have a disability that may be causing a behavior that is not intentional, and secondly, teach them to ways to effectively and appropriately interact with people with non-apparent disabilities. With the passage of HB 77, we hope to reduce potential conflicts between Alaskans with disabilities and law enforcement and make these encounters safer for all parties involved. Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, passed in 1990, protects individuals with disabilities from discrimination in services, programs, and activities provided by state and local government. In 1992, Governor Wally Hickel issued Administrative Order 129 requiring all public entities in Alaska comply with the ADA. Each time a law enforcement officer or corrections officer treats an individual with a disability inappropriately or unfairly, they are at risk of violating the ADA, thus placing the village, municipality, or state in a precarious and potential libelous situation. People with disabilities are best served when they are considered complete and full members of our communities. Alaskans can help make that happen by training police and corrections officers to understand disabilities, their different presentations and behaviors. We believe that standardizing this training will educate officers so that they are prepared to treat all people respectfully, regardless of perceived or actual differences. The added disability icon on a driver's license or ID is simply another tool that would help an officer to first recognize that the person has a disability and then appropriately interact with that individual. HB 77 is about accommodation and inclusion. It's a bill that reinforces individual choice and individual rights. We're advocating for this bill because it's just another tool for law enforcement to reach that goal. In closing, I would like to point out an incident that occurred several months ago in Kodiak. Nicholas Plintikoff was checking the mail in October when members of the Kodiak Police Department responded to a 911 call that ended up with him on the ground, handcuffed and pepper sprayed. Nicholas has autism. The city of Kodiak reported that the man didn't appear developmentally disabled and he failed to obey police commands. These are very common behaviors associated with autism. Nicholas was not charged, but his family is suing Kodiak Police Department, the city, and two law enforcement officers for $100,000 because of that incident. Soldotna-based consultant Greg Russell later determined that the officers did respond appropriately, but also recommended further use of force training for that department. This incident could have been handled much better. Nicholas was not seriously injured, although he was emotionally traumatized. It's obvious that these officers did not use de-escalating techniques that are in the required training on House Bill 77. We are advocating that law enforcement be trained to treat everyone with respect and dignity so this incident has become part of the past. And I would just like to add, taking my governor's council hat off and putting my wallbuster hat back on, that there was a lot of discussion about the ID identification. The reason we chose not to put any kind of medical information or any information at all other than this person has a disability is strictly because of HIPAA violations, and we put that responsibility on the police officer and the person with disability to communicate what that disability is. That way we don't have, there's nothing going into records. We know the person has a disability and that's all that they know. It just enhances communication and prompts the officer to investigate a little further. So there's, in my mind, there's no records that should be kept anywhere other than perhaps a letter until that is rescinded. And there's a lot of comments about the training for the public in DMV. The reason for that is, as we went through, and we've been working on this for 3 years, but last summer we finally came to a conclusion around a table of about 15 people that not one person knew what they really were supposed to do when stopped by a police officer. And that got us to thinking that we're asking the police department to get some training to better interact with us. We should also take some training to better interact with them. So that's why this came about. Just because, for instance, there are some people I know that carry a autism card, for instance, in their pocket. If stopped by a police officer, they're told to pull that card out and show it to the police officer. But from the perspective of a police officer, that can be absolutely the wrong thing to do. They want to see your hands on the wheel. I've learned that. And also, they tell, in some cases, like, for instance, a person with FASD, told them to put their hands on the wheel and then give them their ID. Well, a person with FASD is very concrete. Do they keep their hands on the wheel, or do they give them the ID? They're confused, and that adds stress to the situation. So that's the whole entire reason for the public training. And the ID for the individual with a disability is a form of accommodation, so that it causes communication to ensue between the police officer and the individual. The whole thing, this whole bill, is about safety, and it's about communication. Thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you very much, Mr. Delane, very much. I want to thank everybody that testified today. I know that we have a lot more questions. This bill is going to be coming back, so we'll be getting more questions answered. And with that, we've actually got to the end of this today. I felt like this was a very simple bill that would be very easy to understand, but obviously we did have a lot of questions, and we're going to get those answered. If you've got some questions we can get answered, I've got one here that I'm going to get answered later. You have a comment? Representative Gaddison.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try to be brief. I have a couple that I've been holding. But so I have a nephew that has autism, and he's an adult. And I can tell you that his family, myself being part of it, I love the idea that there's a sticker here that gets the conversation going. But as his family, I want somebody to be able to take that. He doesn't drive. I want him to take the ID. So I like the fact that the ID is part of it. But I want somebody to be able to say, there's clearly a problem here. We're not communicating well, and I think I challenge with the fact that I heard the last speaker state that it's to inspire or to get communication going. But if you know from the get-go that communication is tough, how does the family be able to say, and from a HIPAA standpoint or not, we want somebody to go back somewhere to state he is autistic, he doesn't speak well, his family is such and such. But, I mean, there have been scenarios, be it that, be it it hasn't been all that long ago, that a family member called a welfare check in Anchorage for a somebody with a disability, and I think a psychosis-type disability, hadn't been taking their medication. The person was an adult, so it was above the age of 18, and couldn't get the communication into corrections that this person had not been taking their medication. So how do you, it's been documented that the mother kept calling and calling for an adult, I don't know, 21, 24-year-old, stating that the kid took this type of medication. But so how do you get that so that when they've gone into corrections, that somebody has and I don't know if this absent or whatever, but I would like the opportunity to opt in. And I don't know how that deals with HIPAA laws and such, but I really think that that should be looked at, because there are folks that would really like to have that opportunity. It's called about, it's the safety of their family members, about options. And I just want to put that out there. And
I would assume that this identification on the driver's license, if it's a driver.
Or on the state ID.
Yes, or a state ID would start the communication, and that person that has autism is probably connected with the autism community. They probably have a card that has information about who to call and what to do. I would hope that that's what this would lead to. This is what we're hoping.
Yeah, Representative Gaddis, through the chair, I think that could very easily be kept if you're going to keep it around your neck or something. Yeah. You'd want to keep something like that in there that would say, you know.
Let's just put it this way. I know my nephew. He's 22, and he would keep his ID. That's very important. And I'll stop that. We'll look at some ideas.
Representative Edgman, we're about ready to wrap it up here.
Yeah, just real quick, Mr. Chairman, in support of the bill, as we continue to deliberate it, I just want to make sure that identification card has some, a tribal identification card is part of the conversation. It may already be, I don't see it in the bill, but there's a portion of the bill that I want to ask more about at VPSO as a whole till the next time, but I'll just introduce that now in advance next year.
Thank you. Good idea. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a whole bunch of questions that I'll wait until most of them, but while we have Ms. Erickson on the line, I just want to I've got two questions, or one question, a statement. Ms. Erickson, can you tell us if there is any limit to the maximum number of designations that can be placed on Alaska driver's license or ID card? If Amy
Erickson's- Chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know the answer to that. As you know, there is, I mean, it's prime real estate on there, and we already have a veteran's designation and the heart for the organ donation. And this third would be a lot, but I don't know the exact answer, but I can certainly find out.
I'm just offering you the wherewithal to say how many is too many. So, and then my statement, I guess I'll leave my questions, I'll provide to the chairman, but a couple things. I like the motive behind the bill, but I do have some problem with the implementation and the language. I think it's a real good idea to make sure that people that have a driver's license or ID card have some basic training about what their expected behavior is in an encounter with a public safety officer. I think that's something that's been a glaring omission in the past. It's just good to have some standard expectations. But third, I will say that while there is definitely a legitimate problem with police communications with people with disabilities, it's going to be very difficult to train police to understand or be responsible for their interaction with people who have may have a huge variety of disabilities that manifest themselves different ways or not at all, and for which the behavior might be perfectly normal to do one way but horrible the other way. So we're asking an awful lot of police, and I would be concerned if there's any liability protections to police officers for taking action that might escalate a situation and result in damage versus not taking some action. We're asking an awful lot.
All right. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Okay. Seeing there's no further comments at this time, we're going to bring this bill back. I'm going to put House Bill 77 aside. Ms. Pearson, I want to thank you very much, and I do have some questions already that we'll get some answers to. With that, the next House Committee meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, March 16th at 1:30 p.m. This meeting will be hearing House Bill 268, ADA, Dividend to State Income Valuations, and Senate Bill 53, Advanced Practice Registered Nurses. And with that, at 3:40, we are adjourned.